Chapter 10. "And what do you have planned for this evening?" I asked Beauregard as he laid out a light afternoon repast for myself and Nightingale in the dining room.
"I thought I might visit my aunt,"
he said, carefully adjusting a salver so that it was perfectly aligned with the edge of the table.
"I fear I'm making up a fourth for Reg."
"Oh, crikey," I said. "Is she a fearsome player?"
"Only moderately terrifying, sir,"
said Beauregard.
"But she can be quite demanding in a conversational sense. She likes to be kept informed and sees me as a source of local news."
"Nothing too juicy about me?" I asked with some trepidation.
"One can rely on my discretion, sir."
After leaving the rent party, Amelia had walked me back to Lucy's flat before skipping off to wherever it is she lays her head at night. Or in this case, the early morning, as we headed past all the boot boys, maids, cooks, lift attendants, and doormen hurrying for the subway and the trams downtown. I let myself in and climbed into bed beside Lucy, who rolled over, complaining about Fletcher Henderson not hiring Zutty Singleton, and continued snoring. I put my arms around him and let the scent of his hair lull me to sleep. Breakfast, whatever time we have it, is often hit and miss at Lucy's. So it was over a boiled egg and toast that we discussed what we planned to do that evening, or rather, what we planned not to do, which was to get involved with Nightingale's madcap schemes. Before I left, I made a point of laying out the correct shirt and shoes to go with Lucy's evening dress, because these matters cannot, with any confidence, be left to the man himself. If it had been up to me, I would have stayed happily at home with Lucy, but whatever else, I was still Nightingale's host, and so I set off downtown. Nightingale sat down for our light lunch, in the same plus-fours boots and gaiters that he'd worn on his previous jaunt out to Long Island. A leather golf bag was propped up by the umbrella stand. "Looking to get a round in?" I asked.
"A golf bag is a very useful shape for this sort of op," he said. "Which reminds me."
He reached into his jacket and withdrew an envelope, which he passed to me. It was addressed to a David Mellenby, care of the Folly, on Russell Square, London.
"If I don't make it back, I'd like you to return my trunk to the Folly and send this separately," he said. "The old sticks will probably want a report, but I leave it to you to decide what to reveal."
"Thomas," I started, but he cut me off.
"Lucian is quite correct," he said. "I had no right to drag you into this affair. You must forgive me, Gussie. I did not realize how much you had to lose."
I'm sure you can imagine that I felt downright rotten for the whole duration of my bath, but shaving the old pins and chest required all my concentration, so by the time I was plucking my eyebrows, I'd recovered my poise. Then it was just a question of applying the old vanishing crème pour le visage, and I was ready for the dress. I wore my topper and tails in the cab to Lucy's, it seemed appropriate, and if I chose to carry my heavier cane, then that was only prudence. On the way, I sat upright and alert like a small boy being taken for a Christmas treat, a constant flutter of excitement in my chest. I'd had the dress on before. Madame Zaza had to fit it, and Lucy had to have his own private first night view, but none of that is the same as when you wear it for the first time, as it were, in anger. The feel of the chiffon pressing the silk of your shift against your back and your thighs, the stockings tight as armour as you roll them up your legs, and then the shoes, slipping them on and standing in front of the mirror, taller, stretched out, and suddenly, fabulously, being totally inside yourself, in a way you never truly are at any other time.
"Can I come in yet?"
Lucy called from the hall. "Not yet," I said, because I wanted to be perfect. I took my time putting on my face. I know women and men who can slap on their makeup in under a minute, but I don't have their daily practice. I could practically feel Lucy's impatience radiating through the door like a vestigium as I finished up. When I was ready, I stood facing the door, adjusted my garter, and struck a pose. "Come in," I called, and the door flew open, and Lucy ran in, and then stopped and stared. I have, as readers of my memoirs will know, had a busy life in many ways. I've travelled far and wide, often under protest, and sampled the delights of at least three continents, four if you count Australia, but no sybaritic pleasure, no drink, no food, no wide, magnificent vista can top seeing yourself reflected the way you want to be reflected in your lover's eyes. "Well, I do declare, Augusta," said Lucy in an exaggerated southern accent. "If you ain't the prettiest belle of the ball." He passed me my blue sequined half-mask, and I settled it into place. There were bigger drag balls in New York. At the start of the month, Lucy and I had shaken a fine leg at the Hamilton Lodge Ball at the Rockland Palace, where I realised, much to my chagrin, that my spiffy evening dress with its round neckline and straight hem wasn't going to cut the mustard. You know, it's an odd thing, but until that evening, I'd never thought of myself as a competitive chap. I knew plenty of them from school and university, Nightingale being a prime example of the type. Chaps who couldn't attend a three-legged race at a village fete without being desperate to win. But beyond some light betting at Goodwood and the like, I'd never allowed myself to become exercised, if that's the right word. But no longer. Harry Walter, winner of the Hamilton Lodge Masquerade, had worn an asymmetrical hemline and heels. Now I did, too, and as we swept up the red carpet in front of the Roxy Ballroom, I walked with all the confidence of a man who'd practiced wearing them every day for 2 weeks. Flashbulbs popped, and their light followed me and Lucy as if we were royalty. Better, as if we were Hollywood movie stars arriving at a premiere. The ballroom proper was a big rectangular box with the stage at one end, a dance floor in the middle, with tables all around. Above them, on a kind of balcony, were the private boxes where what Lucy called the downtown gawpers gathered to enjoy the show. "They think they're above us," Lucy said when he saw me glancing up. "But we're the ones down here putting on the Ritz." The orchestra at the back of the stage was playing "Everybody Loves My Baby" as we headed for the tables. "Oh my," said a figure surging through the crowd. "Don't you look pretty, both of you?" It was Amelia, or perhaps Coco, or perhaps somebody new. The young woman had shaved her head down to a mere shadow, the better to seat her top hat at a jaunty angle. Her mask was black velvet, with black glass beads stitched to give her eyes the mischievous slant of a feline. To match mask and topper, she wore a black velvet tail coat with matching trousers, but instead of a dress shirt, a top of some silver-blue material that was so translucent that she might as well have left it off entirely, for all the modesty it provided. I couldn't take my eyes off it. "You must tell me where you got that shirt," I said. "He's so single-minded," she said to Lucy.
"And who are you today?" asked Lucy.
Amelia gave a gay laugh and, slipping between us, took our arms and led us towards a table. "You might as well call me Coco," she said. "I'm always Coco on the inside." Coco had certainly got us an excellent table, not too close to the band, but right up against the dance floor and strategically placed with regards to the bar so that a steady stream of waiters passed by. Coco accosted one as soon as we were seated, and soon we were drinking sidecars and watching the crowd. "Aunt Delilia sends her love," said Coco, "and trusts that you will emerge triumphant." The band broke into Shim Sham Shimmy, and as one, the whole crowd hit the dance floor. Lucy took my hand and we jumped up to join them. The rules of the ball were simple. If you came as a lady, then you could only dance with the gentleman, and vice versa. Where Coco fitted into this schema, it was impossible to say, and she cheerfully danced with both me and Lucy, and with a very short white man in a bustle and a ruff. And so the night continued, with breaks for cocktails, gossip, and sizing up the competition. I tried to pace myself since the competition parade, into which I was entered, would commence at 10:30, and it wouldn't do for me to appear flushed and sweaty. I don't think men truly appreciate the effort that goes into staying beautiful. It's practically a full-time job. Certainly Lucy's evening jacket was already taking on its customary rumpled appearance when I recaptured him at the start of Squeeze Me. It was midway through that number when she made her presence felt. Lucy stumbled, which is not too surprising an occurrence. I tripped, and I heard Coco swear as her partner, who looked like she bent iron bars for a living, stepped on her foot. The sensation passed through the dance floor, a hungry, miserable, angry feeling, gnawing like a rat at our happiness. I looked around and spotted her, a tall, thin figure in unfashionably long white taffeta and matching veil. She moved slowly across the floor, stepping and twirling to a different, sadder rhythm. Lloyd Beaumont, the pianist at the Alexandra, had said she couldn't dance, but it was obvious to me that she could, only she was stepping to a tune nobody else could hear. "Damn," I heard Coco say.
"Is that her?"
asked Lucy. "Let's go back to the table," I said. Now I have to say that the only reason I didn't immediately hide under said table was the iron will of the Berrycloth Youngs, and the fact that such an action could seriously disarrange my dress. As I said previously, beauty does not come without sacrifice. We did indulge in a round of white ladies, which is essentially a sidecar, only made with bathtub gin, that had a dashed fine kick and helped soothe my nerves. Thankfully, it was only a matter of time before the cloud of Morel's presence passed from the face of the sun, and light and laughter were quickly restored. I think Lucy, Coco, and I, not to mention the Roxy Ballroom itself, might even have survived the evening unscathed if it hadn't been for a sudden call of nature. Now that the hour approached, the prospect of parading on my own in front of the assembled crowd had made me unaccountably nervous, and so I went in search of a suitable venue to relieve myself. Both the gentlemen's and the ladies' on the ground floor were filled to bursting, but I knew there were additional facilities on the floor above. Up the stairs, there were two long hallways allowing access to the boxes, where even now the gawpers were ogling the show from above like visitors to Bedlam. Emerging from the stairwell, I spied, much to my relief, a ladies' powder room across the hall, and had just reached it when the queerest couple came running around the far corner. One I recognised immediately as Mr. Clydesdale, a.k.a. the horse. The other was a small child of perhaps five, whom he was holding above his head as he ran. He held her by the waist as she stretched horizontally, with arms flung out as if flying. Her skin was, as foreshadowed, the colour of old ivory, and her hair, escaping from tight braids, was a shocking platinum blonde. Her eyes were hidden by dainty, child-sized aviator's goggles with smoked lenses, and her mouth was open in a happy scream. This could only be Morel's child, and I flattened myself against the wall in a most unladylike manner. As the horse thundered past, the girl turned her head to look at me. "Stop, stop, stop," she yelled down at her steed, who obediently skidded to a halt. I didn't wait to watch her dismount. Instead, I pushed my way into the powder room, waved at the attendant, found an empty stall and locked myself in. For a moment, I thought I might have escaped. But then I heard the hallway door creak open, and Mr. Clydesdale's high-pitched, musical voice remonstrating with his charge. "You can't come in here," I heard the child say. "It's for ladies only." Then the door closing and small footsteps slapping on the tiled floor. the attendant asked whether the child needed help, but was politely rebuffed. The footsteps stopped outside my stall. "Hello," said the child, and her voice had lost the brashness with which she had addressed Mr. Clydesdale, or even the polite firmness she had used on the attendant. This voice was timid but determined. "Hello, my name is Oriand. What's yours?" I looked around wildly for escape, but while the stall was equipped with a window for ventilation, it was far too small for me to wriggle out of. "You smell funny," said Oriand. "Are you a fairy?" "My mama is a fairy." According to my watch, I had at least 15 minutes before the parade. All I had to do was stay quiet and wait for the child to lose interest and wander off. "My mama says that one day we'll be rescued," said Oriand in a sad little voice. "But you know what? I think she's just making things up. Do you think we'll be rescued?" I thought that her rescuer was probably, even now, breaking into a big house far away on Long Island, which begged the question, did she really need rescuing? It was then that I made my fatal mistake. But it's true that I've always been led astray by my soft heart. "Do you need rescuing, dear?" I asked, taking care to pitch my voice as high as I could without cracking. "Mama isn't happy," said Oriange. "She cries when she thinks I can't hear her, and she says she wishes she could go across the sea to live in the forest again. She says that she has sent ever so many messages that somebody is bound to come rescue us." "Good-o," I said. "Are you sure it's not you?" she asked. "I'm sorry," I said. "It's okay," said Oriand in a small voice, and I heard her disconsolate steps. Now, I know what you're thinking. "Gussie, this is really too much. What kind of person are you that you refuse to help a little girl in her hour of need? The shame of it. What would your parents say? What would your headmaster have said if he could see you now? They'd demand to know why I was wearing a dress, having carnal relations with a coloured American chappie. That's what they would have said. Although, no doubt, once they'd worked their way through that list of sins, they'd be pretty damn miffed with me for not immediately rising to the occasion. I checked the time. I had 10 minutes before the parade. It was then I conceived a corker of a plan, which just goes to show that even the limited brain of Augustus Berrycloth Young is, when push comes to shove, capable of great things. If all that was stopping Morel from escaping on her own was the fact that her child was held hostage, then should I spirit away the child, her mother would be perfectly capable of taking matters into her own hands. Nightingale needn't be involved, except perhaps to provide passage back to Blighty and suffer the opprobrium of the old sticks at the Folly. After all, what was the point of wearing a mask to a masquerade if you couldn't hide behind it? I left the sanctuary of my stall, and pausing only to tip the attendant, slipped out into the hallway. Oriand and her goonish nanny were nowhere to be seen, but I could hear her yelling cheerfully from around the corner. I headed after them, and as I did, a tall figure in a beautiful crimson dress with matching shawl and mask emerged from one of the boxes. Normally I would have stopped to inquire where they had obtained their dress, but time was pressing, so I nodded politely and hurried past, as fast as I could, in my heels. I turned the corner onto the long balcony that ran above the orchestra, just in time to come face to face with Oriand as she reluctantly dismounted from the horse. "Hello," I said, holding out my hand. "Would you like to be in a parade?" "Yes, please," said Oriand, seizing my hand. The horse stepped forward to remonstrate, but I adopted the tone and manner of my dear old mater, who never would take any interference from anyone. In fact, she once upbraided a high court judge in his own court while she was giving evidence. "You don't mind me borrowing your darling child?" I said. "Just for a few minutes, I promise. I just know if she parades with me, I shall win for sure." I checked my watch. Look at the time. I'll have her right back. I promise. I don't know whether Mr. Clydesdale was bamboozled by my manner or had been instructed not to make waves, but the poor chap halted and looked flustered. I was about to take advantage and sweep off when a small sound caused my blood to freeze in my veins. And the sound of a revolver being cocked is a very small sound in the scheme of things, the sort of small noise one might overlook, what with the girl's happy shrieks and the muffled jazz floating up from the ballroom, but not when it occurs a scant few inches behind one's head.
"Ah," said a familiar voice, "if it isn't Miss Bertram Wilberforce, acclaimed London musicologist and fag about town. Although, I have to say, you do look rather swell as a girl."
Chapter 11. It was Mr. Charles Yeager, and I was quite pleased that he was a talkative style of cove, given the alternatives.
"And the dress is splendid," he said. "Where's your friend?"
Nobody likes to be in mortal peril, except perhaps Thomas Nightingale, not least because the old bean has a tendency to work in a less than satisfactory manner, which probably explains why my next words were, "Which one?"
"Not the coon,"
he said.
"The Englishman."
"I wish I knew," I said. The horse had approached Oriente and put both meaty paws on her shoulders. The little girl squeezed my hand.
"Let go of the child,"
said Mr. Yeager, and added,
"Now, if you will."
When I hesitated, I let go and the horse drew Oriente away. She looked up at me with a stricken expression. "Don't worry," I said. "Everything will turn out just spiffy, you'll see."
"That's the spirit, Miss Wilberforce,"
said Mr. Yeager.
"Or should I call you Augustus Berrycloth Young?"
He rattled off my address, which, had my blood not already been the temperature of the sort of water one associates with icebergs and penguins, would have chilled it further. Down in the ballroom, I heard the orchestra's brass section break into an up-tempo fanfare. The parade had begun. All my hard work had been wasted and, worse, by the time the next ball came around, my wonderful dress would be out of date. For some reason, this didn't seem to matter. Mr. Yeager told the horse to take the girl to the others
and then get on the horn to Bracknell and tell him to get going straight away,
he said.
The chimes of midnight will just have to sound early this evening.
The horse started dragging Oriente away.
"Now,"
started Mr. Yeager, and if I had to guess, based on my extensive reading, he was about to continue,
"what are we going to do with you?"
But little Oriente had her own plans. She fetched the horse such a kick on the shins that the big man shouted and let go of her arm. Before he could grab it again, she darted forward towards me. I felt I should do something appropriately heroic at that point, but before I could formulate a plan, I felt a shock to the back of my head, and I stumbled forward onto my knees. There was no pain, but darkness was closing around my vision, and I found it impossible to do more than stop myself toppling further. "I've been shot," I thought, "and I haven't even done anything heroic." I felt Oriente throw her arms around my neck, and that's when the pain and the need to vomit nearly overwhelmed me. I had the rummiest thought that the pain meant I probably wasn't dead. But what would I know? I've never been shot before. "You promised," Oriente hissed in my ear, sounding annoyed, which I thought was extremely unfair. A very long way away, Mr. Yeager was giving instructions to the horse.
"Get Pat and Alzi up here," he said. "I'll take care of these two, since that seems beyond your talents."
I didn't like the sound of being taken care of, so I summoned up my courage and put my hand to the back of my head. It was tender and hurt like the blazes, but was gloriously free of any bullet holes. I felt suddenly a great deal more chipper. I suppose not being shot can do that. But unfortunately, Mr. Yeager proved himself a bit of a mind reader.
"Stay down, you stupid faggot,"
he snarled,
or I'll shoot you for sure.
There was still a dire throbbing at the back of my head, but the urge to revisit my supper had waned. I shifted my position, slowly, so as not to alarm the maniac with a gun, so that I could see said maniac, and the gun, of course, which was still distressingly aimed in my general direction. Orion tightened her grip on me, her face puckered into an expression of determination. "What the fuck is going on out here?" said someone. "Charles? Is that you?" The corpus must have left their boxes and were loudly demanding to know what was happening. I subsequently heard that both the Rockefellers and Langston Hughes were there that night, but, being on my knees, I was not in a position to confirm this. I did feel Morell before I saw her, the rage pouring off her like heat from an open oven. Jaeger grabbed Orion and put her between him and her mother. He didn't do anything so gauche as to aim the revolver at the girl, but the threat was implied.
"Morell,"
said Jaeger,
"get rid of these people."
She hesitated, rigid with indecision, before turning to hiss at the crowd of swells who had begun to fill the balcony. I felt it myself. What we learned magical types call the seducere, or the glamour. The assembled gorpers turned and shuffled off back towards their boxes, which was pretty dashed impressive for a single fae. It was then that the omnibus of reason made a sudden reappearance and collided with the bean of Berrycloth Young. Jaeger wasn't keeping Morell for her skill with enchanting musical instruments. It was her glamour that Jaeger sought to utilize. How many deals had she tipped in his favor? How many rivals had been compelled into making mistakes? I was so taken with my own cleverness that it took me a moment to notice that one of the gorpers had defied the glamour and stayed where they were. It was the figure in the crimson dress, taking a most unfeminine stance with hands on hips and shoulders thrown back. Despite the scarlet mask and headdress, I suddenly had no doubt as to who this was.
"Mr. Jaeger,"
said Nightingale,
"this has all gone far enough. I suggest you release Morell and the girl into my care. Then we can all walk away from this with a minimum of unpleasantness."
"Well, my ancestors fought at Valley Forge," said Mr. Jaeger, "so no dice."
Nightingale took a step forward, but before he could act further, Jaeger seized Orion around the waist and called upon Morell to
kill that man.
Without hesitating, and rather alarmingly, Morell threw herself at Nightingale, who raised his hand and conjured an invisible shield to fend her off.
"Gussie,"
he shouted,
"grab the girl."
One thing I'll say for Mr. Jaeger, he was not slow on the uptake. He immediately took another swing at me with the butt of the revolver, but I was already rolling out of the way. I kicked out wildly and must have caught him with the narrow heel of my shoe because he cursed and hopped back. I jumped up and confronted him, readying my own shield spell in case he tried to shoot me. Behind me I could hear wood splintering as Morell and Nightingale biffed it out. But I didn't dare look round because Jaeger fired once, twice, three times. The shield took two shots, but the third whiffled past my head in a most unpleasant fashion. Now I'd nerved myself up to smack Jaeger in the head with an Impello Palmer, but before I could, the worryingly equine Mr. Clydesdale came running up behind him, backed by a pair of goons I recognized from our boat trip. All carried pistols and didn't hesitate for a moment when Jaeger told them to open fire. Since discretion is the better part of valor, I vaulted over the balcony and dropped into the ballroom below. As I fell, I could see that the hopeful contestants, oblivious to the shooting going on above their heads, were lined up on the stage, awaiting the signal to parade around the edge of the dance floor. I'm going to make the contest after all, I thought, as the stage rushed up to meet me. No wizard has figured out a way to fly yet, but there are a couple of spells a chap might use in extremis to break his fall. extremis, like vaulting a banister 20 feet above the stage in the Roxy. It's the sort of thing a chap might use when escaping out of the private rooms of a public house, when an uncharitable landlord has called the Rozzers over a minor disagreement with regards to the bill. As a result, it is one of the few spells I can do in a hurry while squiffy. It sort of thickens the air near the ground so that it slows one's fall just prior to impact. Timing is crucial, or you break a shin bone, or worse. Mine was a bit off, and I staggered on landing. I heard a crack, and a leg went out from under me. I'd broken a heel, but I didn't get a chance to mourn because the goons on the balcony opened fire. The lineup of hopeful queens dissolved into panic, and I threw a scatter of fireballs up at the triggermen. They were slow-moving, noisy things, the sort you use for japes on Guy Fawkes night, but they had the desired effect of causing the goons to stop shooting and scatter. It may also just be possible that they are what set the Roxy Ballroom on fire that night, but we will never know for sure. I limped back into the shelter of the balcony overhang and watched the crowd stampeding for the exit. Presumably, Jaeger would be doing the same and taking Orionde with him. He'd have a car nearby, so, to stop him, I'd have to escape the Roxy and cut him off before he could reach it. Nightingale was counting on me to recover the girl, and now I was going to be forced to do it in stockinged feet, but not alone, because Lucy and Coco quickly joined me. "We need to get out," I said. "There's bulls blocking the side doors," said Coco. "It's a raid." So we joined the perfumed herd, making for the main entrance. But unfortunately, that was also replete with members of the local constabulary. I didn't care because my blood was up. And when the blood of the berry-clothed youngs is up, it's jolly well up, is all I'm saying. When I spotted the same bejowled specimen of corrupt policing as had terrorized us in Lucy's flat, I decided that luck had been, if not a lady, then a magnificent queen tonight. Sergeant Bracknell was standing between the crowd and the exit, with his hands on his hips and a sneer on his lips.
"Everybody can fucking stay where they are," he shouted, spittle flying from his lips. "You all know the drill by now. I want those purses turned out and won't be tied any of you faggots who tries to cheat me."
Now, some of these faggots I knew to be longshoremen who work the docks, and the type of chaps who would gladly punch a policeman regardless of what it might do to their manicure. The longshoreman's manicure, not the police officer's, I mean. But backing up this despicable sergeant was a line of policemen brandishing their truncheons and looking very much like they relished the idea of using them.
"There's no point trying to fight them," Lucy had said. "They always get their licks in."
I may not be the greatest practitioner to have graced the playing fields of Casterbrook. I may have chosen to squander my talents on pranks and japes, and I most definitely am not in the weight class of Nightingale. But I am a keeper of the secret flame, a sayer of the three sacred oaths, and a man who carries a staff of power, except when it clashed with that evening's outfit. But, metaphorically speaking, I carry it with me wherever I go. First, I seized the officers' truncheons and belabored them around their faces. While they staggered under that onslaught, I snapped their belts so that their deeply unattractive blue wool trousers fell around their knees. I probably didn't need to flourish my hand to grab hold of the soles of the clodhopping boots and yank their owners off their feet. But I always say, if you can't put a bit of showmanship into your magic, what's the bally point? The crowd had fallen into a sudden silence, and this had obviously intimated to Sergeant Bracknell that things were going awry. He turned to goggle at his fallen men, who were even then writhing around on the floor in a pleasing mixture of pain and embarrassment. I used that interlude to work my way to the front of the crowd, because what I was about to attempt needed a bit of finesse some daring, and a great deal of concentration, because tonight, at the Spring Masquerade, Sergeant Unpleasant of the New York Police Department was about to be well and truly crockered. Crocker was one of those bright boys who are given a scholarship so that they may suffer the delights of boarding school life. He was before my time, but a bit of a legend, and the legend was that his family were in the rag trade in Manchester, and that the precocious Crocker had sought to adapt magic to assist his parents' profession. The result was a spell designed to pull garments apart at the seams that has been passed down by generations of merry-hearted pranksters. No doubt Nightingale knows it, but I doubt the old sticks of the Folly Council do. One peculiarity of the Crocker process, as it is known to those in the know, is that it only works on clothes that are being worn at the time, something to do with the topographical conformity with the subject's morphological field, but I admit I may have been asleep for most of that class. It's a complicated spell, fifth or seventh order, depending on how you count your inflectes, but I've always been rather good at it, and during my university days it provided me with a great deal of happiness. I've also had it cast on me, so I happen to know for a fact that the victim of the spell is aware, just for a moment, of the sense of thousands of little fingers sliding along their bare skin. That part is not nearly as much fun as it sounds, although some more adventurous chaps I know swear by it as a warm-up, so to speak, before intimacy. Bracknell gave a startled squawk as his uniform was ripped from his body, leaving him standing with bare arms and legs akimbo. I was disappointed to note that he still favoured a woolen all-in-one union suit, but at least had the decency to own a proper pair of sock gaiters. He looked first at his own state of undress, then at the crowd staring back. It was hard to say who was more shocked, and the impasse might have endured had not the distinctive sound of gunshots sounded from somewhere up in the ballroom. The crowd surged forward, and that was the last I ever saw of Sergeant Bracknell, although Lucy assured me he survived relatively unscathed and went to live with a maiden aunt in Jersey City, which, in Coco's opinion, was a fate worse than death. I was amazed to hear he'd survived, because we only made it out to the street by allowing ourselves to be carried along in the tide of red velvet, pink taffeta, and a particularly nice mink stole I was tempted to snatch as I was swept past. Out on 7th Avenue, it had started to rain. The masquerade crowd was legging it and mingling with the inevitable crowd of local sightseers, there being nothing a Harlem crowd loves more than a free show. A line of black police cars were being guarded by a couple of officers who had drawn their revolvers and were looking around for someone to shoot. I heard a childish scream of rage, and looking over the heads of the milling crowd, I spotted Jaeger carrying Oriand across the avenue. Ahead of him was parked a bright yellow Rickenbacker two-seater, with the large shape of Mr. Clydesdale waiting nervously beside it. 7th Avenue is the widest in Harlem, and I've met enough chappies who fought in the war to feel a bit queasy when running across open ground against armed opponents, something I've done surprisingly often in my career. In spite of my strenuous efforts to avoid armed opponents, open ground, or indeed serious exertion of any kind. Thus it was, I had my shield up when Mr. Clydesdale opened fire. What with the ruination of my dress, my missed opportunity to be declared queen of the spring ball, and my broken heel, I was not minded to be kind to Mr. Clydesdale, and so, once I had separated him from his pistol, I threw him into the basement area of a nearby speakeasy. Unfortunately, this gave Jaeger time to bundle Oriand into the two-seater and drive off like Mr. Toad in a furious roar and screech of tires. "Blast," I said. Nightingale arrived to stand beside me. His feathered headdress was missing, but like me, he'd kept the mask and most of his dress.
"Was that Jaeger?"
he asked. "It was."
"Blast,"
he said. I was about to say that we needed our own wheels when Lucy pulled up in a black Ford with Coco standing on the running board. I was about to ask where he'd obtained the car when a fusillade of shots peppered it from behind. I looked and saw half a dozen angry policemen running towards us and waving their pistols in a most animated fashion. "Is this a police car?" I asked Lucy.
"It was the only one with the engine running," he said.
"Get in,"
said Nightingale. "Get going," said Coco. "I'll take care of the cops."
"I say,"
started Nightingale, but before he could say more, Lucy put his foot down. I looked back and saw Coco walking jauntily back towards the line of police, swinging a cane. My cane, I realized, and wondered whether she knew how to use its hidden potential. I never got a chance to see because at that moment, Lucy swung us right into a cross street and I lost sight of her. I asked Nightingale what had happened to Morel.
"Fortunately, I managed to interpose a number of Jaeger's men between us and, while she was distracted, made my escape."
He leaned out of the car to check our rear.
"But I doubt she will be far behind us."
I've heard New York called the city that never sleeps, and, certainly unlike London, the traffic barely falters until the early hours. If anything, with fewer pedestrians, everyone drives faster, especially the cabbies. Certainly Lucy did so, particularly when Nightingale found the switch that activated the siren. It was great fun to be roaring along in the back seat of a flivver and being on the wrong side, as it were, of that whooping siren. Lucy shouted something. I leaned forward to hear him.
"He's nowhere to be seen," said Lucy.
"He'll be heading for Long Island,"
said Nightingale.
"Make for the Queensborough Bridge."
"What if he takes his boat?" I asked.
"Once I realized no one was at the house," said Nightingale, "I took the liberty of sinking it on my return to the city. We know where he's going. We just need to catch up before he gets there."
"He's in a Rickenbacker," I said, "and this is a Ford."
"Good point,"
said Nightingale. At that moment, racing down the tunnel, formed by the houses and the elevated train track above our heads, the street lamps and passing cars thwopping past like the horn blares of Daybreak Express, even if back then Duke Ellington had not yet conceived that particular gem, and the shrill of the siren echoing back off the buildings like Cootie Williams' shrieking solo, watching the quick motions of Lucy's head as he guided our passage with total concentration. For that moment, I thought I might understand just what it was like to be Thomas Nightingale. Lucy swerved onto the roadway up to the Queensborough Bridge, throwing me painfully against the door and reminding me that I was not the redoubtable Nightingale, but rather good old Gussie Berrycloth Young, and I liked nightclubs and jazz, cups of coffee in the morning, and long, slow evenings with Lucy. As we entered the lower deck of the bridge, Nightingale cut the siren.
"A bridge is a psychological break,"
he said, which frankly mystified me.
"With luck, Mr. Jaeger will believe himself to be free of pursuit and slow his pace. We may be able to catch up."
The borough of Queens is much like Manhattan or the Bronx. Townhouses, tenements, mansions, and elevated railways. It was less busy than Manhattan, and Lucy picked up the pace as best as the old Ford could manage. There are, Lucy explained, half a dozen different routes through Queens, but if you are heading for Manhasset, then once you are past the great burning reek of Flushing, it was the road they confusingly named Broadway. And dashed if Nightingale hadn't been right, because on a straight stretch just past Little Neck, we caught sight of a flash of the yellow two-seater caught in the headlamps of an overtaking car. Jaeger may have been dawdling by the standards of the Rickenbacker, but our poor flivver was growling and snarling just to close the gap.
"Damn it!"
shouted Nightingale.
"He's almost home."
I realized that I recognized the lane we were speeding down. It was the same one in which we had stumbled on Coco sleeping in a car. Jaeger's estate could only be half a mile further up. Nightingale tensed, and I guessed he was about to risk clipping the fleeing car's rear wheel. I was fearfully anxious and looking to see what I could do, which meant I was staring straight at Oriande when she made her move. The car swerved and Jaeger tried to stop as she jumped to her feet and, throwing her arms around his head, pulled backwards. It's just possible that she was trying to break his neck, but we'll never know. The rummy thing is that my memory of what happened next is in pieces, flashes of images and bursts of noise all scattered out of order. So sometimes, looking back, I hear the crunching sound of our flivver striking the back of Jaeger's car before I see said flivver swerving and flopping over on its side. Lucy is shouting. Nightingale hisses an expletive over and over again. And then there is the taste of grass and the smell of burning rubber and the stars above. Then suddenly the whole dashed experience crashes back down and I find I am lying on my back on the grassy verge, staring up at the sky.
Gussie,
shouts Nightingale.
I need a wear-light now, damn it.
I sat up and conjured a wear-light with almost no thought at all. Well, he was a prefect when I was a bug, and while I didn't fag for him directly, I'd been collared by him for jobs often enough to jump to it on command. Ahead, illuminated by my conjuration, was Jaeger's Rickenbacker, still on its side. Beside me was our stolen flivver, its bonnet crumpled and front wheels splayed flat. I looked around wildly for Lucy and sighed relief when he turned out to be standing beside me.
Are you okay?
He asked, and helped me to my feet. Where's the girl? I asked.
Here,
called Nightingale, emerging from behind the two-seater with Oriande in his arms. When she saw us, she squirmed out of his grasp and ran towards us. I went up in the air, she said brightly. Did you? I said and picked her up. She was a heavy little thing.
What happened to Jaeger?
Asked Lucy. Nightingale made a casual gesture with his left hand, and with a groan, the two-seater righted itself back onto its wheels, which promptly collapsed. Jaeger was still in the front seat and looking, unfortunately, not very much worse for wear. He turned his head and gave us a baleful look. His mouth worked as if he wanted to say something, but he couldn't think of anything terrible enough to curse us with. He clawed at the side door, which resisted until finally he swiveled in his seat and kicked it open. Charles Jaeger came out of his car like a fury, bent on terrible retribution, but before either Nightingale or I could act, Lucy shot him twice in the chest with his revolver. The man looked positively nonplussed by the development, but then his eyes rolled up and he fell on his face. Lucian turned to face us and returned his revolver to his pocket.
My apologies, gentlemen, but if you take a moment to consider the facts, you'll see that was the only way, he said. A rich white man like that would not take an affront to his power lightly. He owned the police, the politicians, and the gangsters. Gussie and I would not have survived for very long.
I expected Nightingale to make at least a token protest, but instead he shrugged.
Help me get him back in the car,
he said. Since I was holding Oriande, I was spared the gruesome task of levering Jaeger's body back into the two-seater. Oriande said nothing. Outraged, shocked, stunned, I couldn't tell.
I think even the local sheriff will notice he's been shot in the chest, said Lucy, as we walked away from the crash.
This will not be a problem,
said Nightingale, and clicked his fingers. I sensed the clockwork catch of his magic, and behind us the car exploded. I felt the heat of it on my back and hurried on.
I see,
said Lucy, looking back.
That's a neat trick.
A useful one, certainly,
said Nightingale. Much as I love a stroll in the moonlight, I said, I feel the sight of us in a state of déshabillé may provoke comment.
In Queens, said Lucy, they'll just think you're a local.
So how did you get that dress? I asked Nightingale.
It wasn't easy,
he said. I might have pressed for more, but at that moment we were illuminated by the headlights of an oncoming sedan which pulled up beside us. Orion shrieked and wriggled out of my arms. There was an answering cry, and Morel squirmed out of the side window like an eel and swept up her daughter in her arms. While they spun in a little happy dance, the sedan's driver's door opened to reveal Coco wearing a policeman's tunic and a grin. "Hey, do you ladies need a lift?" she said. Chapter 12. Coco drove us back to my flat, which Nightingale pointed out was both larger than Lucy's and more defensible. To my astonishment, Beauregard was waiting up for us when we returned, and showed no surprise at the inclusion of Morel and her daughter in our party. Given recent events, I was loath to let Lucy out of my sight, a policy with which Nightingale, to my continued astonishment, concurred.
"The police know his address,"
he said.
"Best that he stays here until the situation is clarified."
Since Morel and Oriand were in the guest room, Beauregard made up the sofa for Nightingale and suggested that Lucy should share my bed, which caused Lucy to choke on his nightcap.
"In extremis," said Beauregard, "there is nothing untoward about good friends sharing."
Coco saw us settled and then departed for a party in the village. "The night is young," she said.
"Yes, it is,"
said Lucy as we retired. The morning was also young when Lucy and I were awoken by Orion jumping up and down on my bed. "I saw an airplane," she said.
"How nice,"
said Lucy, and pulled the covers over his head. I sat up, and she stood in front of me, face to face, as if defying me to react. Her eyes were an extraordinarily beautiful hazel colour, flecked with gold and red, and, indeed, slotted just like a goat's. When the sunlight struck her face, she frowned and shaded her eyes with her hand. "Do you have an airplane?" she asked. I admitted that I did not, which seemed to disappoint her. "Why not?" she demanded. I vouchsafed that it had never occurred to me to buy an airplane, which Orion seemed to find an extraordinary oversight on my part. Beauregard wafted in with coffee on a tray, and with barely a glance at Lucy's recumbent form, turned to Orion and held out her smoked glass goggles.
"I believe the young lady mislaid these," he said.
Orion slipped them on, and, distracted by whatever thought processes drive the actions of small children, jumped off the bed and scuttled out.
"I'm afraid breakfast this morning will be without bacon, liver, or kidneys," said Beauregard.
This was a blow. I'd been counting on a proper breakfast.
"The young lady's mother,"
explained Beauregard,
"became somewhat peckish during the night and seized upon the same for a midnight feast. Fortunately, she did not attempt to operate the range, or the outcome could have been a great deal more severe."
"What? Shake them raw?"
"I believe so, sir."
"All of them?" I asked, since I knew Beauregard liked to keep the larder well stocked.
"The lady's appetite is certainly prodigious."
"I know it's Sunday, but I suggest we order in fresh supplies, tout suite."
"A wise precaution,"
said Beauregard. Later that morning, Coco arrived, trailed by half a dozen young coloured boys carrying steamer trunks and freshly wrapped parcels.
"Gifts from the Queen of Joy," said Coco.
Said gifts, I couldn't help notice, consisting mostly of all the clothes, toiletries and amusements that a mother and daughter might need on a steamer heading for Europe. There was much frenetic activity as Coco, Orion and Morel tried on all the clothes. Lucy slept through the whole thing, but Nightingale and I took ourselves down to the shipping office to book passage for three on the SS de Grasse. The clerk protested that all the first-class accommodation had been booked, but I bribed him by promising to obtain tickets for the girlfriend at the Vanderbilt, plus a hefty wad of cabbage, as they say here. Nightingale was suitably grateful and promised to wire me the money once he was in London. As we strolled back to Washington Square, I extolled my theory, formulated in extremis, I might add, that Charles Yeager had been using Morel's glamour to buy influence and power. Lucien did say that he harboured political ambitions, I said.
It would have been stopped, said Nightingale. The Americans aren't any keener on that sort of thing than we are.
I've seen nothing official since I arrived here, I said.
You might want to keep it that way,
said Nightingale,
assuming you stay.
Do you think I should? We stopped in the square for a moment to enjoy the green.
I've never really understood what you might call physical love,
said Nightingale.
But I do understand the bonds of friendship and family. You and Lucien are in love, and God knows that's precious enough to be worth fighting for. But, more importantly, worth ignoring what polite society has to say on the matter.
I was literally struck dumb at that moment, which I think Nightingale took for incomprehension, for he grinned at me.
Get a house somewhere, fill it full of Lucien and Jazz, and whatever else takes your fancy,
he said.
I'll tell the old sticks of the folly you're discreetly keeping an eye on the Americans.
And will I be keeping an eye?
The occasional letter, Gussie,
said Nightingale.
So I know you're doing well.
We strolled on while I digested this, and the old bean, obviously seeking a safer topic of conversation, advanced a notion which I put into words. If Morel was kept around to put the fluence on bigwigs and whatnot, I said, what were all the visits to the balls and nightclubs about?
She may draw a form of sustenance from the excitement and the emotions,
said Nightingale.
Perhaps she'll tell me on the voyage home.
And where will home be?
That's up to Morel,
said Nightingale.
If she has no other plans, I know a family in Kent where mother and daughter would pass without too much comment.
I suppose your friend
Molly.
Your friend Molly will be pleased?
I expect she will bake me a cake.
The next morning we arose early to travel down to the docks to wave goodbye and ensure Nightingale departed safely. Coco met us there, presumably so she could report back to Alelia Walker. Well, he's a sinner, said Coco as the liner was hauled away by tugs, gulls dipping and screaming above. Candy-coated. Just as long as he sins on the other side of the Atlantic, I said. After that, we repaired to my apartment for lunch. I had, of course, sounded out Beauregard in advance and asked if he could see his way to take up butlering as a profession. He said he would be most satisfied to act in that capacity, providing it was left to him to select the staff. If you must, I conceded, and rejoiced that the task would not fall to me. That left only one last possible impediment, and even as I hesitated to raise it, Beauregard anticipated the very contingency.
Will Mr. Gibbs be joining the household?
He asked. I said he would, and tentatively, as a boy asking for more gruel in a workhouse, I inquired if this would create a difficulty.
Not at all,
said Beauregard.
Mr. Gibbs is a fine young man from an excellent family. His only disadvantage is his lack of sartorial flair.
This is true, Mr. Beauregard, I said. Perhaps together we can work to remedy that.
Quite so, sir,
said Beauregard. Over lunch, I put the proposition to Lucy himself. He was agreeable on two conditions.
This house will, of course, be above 110th Street, he said.
Naturally, I said. There's bound to be a suitable property on Edgecombe or 138th. And a second condition that you might not like so much. Anything, dear heart, I said, although not without the tiniest twinge of trepidation. You say magic is like jazz, he said. And so it is, I said.
Good, said Lucien. Because I want you to teach me. Historical note. Alelia Walker was a real person, and the story of her life and times is worth reading up on, as is that of her mother, Madam C.J. Walker, who built a business out of nothing in the teeth of personal and institutional racism and sexism.
The Harlem Renaissance was equally astonishing, as was the flowering of queer culture that went alongside it. New York has always seen itself as the metropolis, the beating heart of the modern world, and however skeptically we view that claim now, in the 1920s it was incontrovertibly true. I couldn't find any reliable plans for the Savoy or the Rockland Palace, so I have invented a venue for my imaginary spring masquerade. But I have tried to stay true to the extraordinary spirit of the times.
This concludes The Masquerades of Spring by Ben Aaronovitch, narrated by Cobner Holdbrook Smith. Copyright 2024 by Ben Aaronovitch. Production copyright 2024 by the Orion Publishing Group Limited. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Jabberwocky Literary Agency, working in association with Zeno Agency Limited, and was produced in the year 2024 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.